We'll take a quick spin through the week in the global economy as we do of a Friday afternoon on this broadcast. And we'll start a new series today looking at the business behind the police officer's badge. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday. This one is the first day of May. If you can believe that, it's great to have you with us as always. Get going is what we're going to do right now. A brisk yet detailed exploration of the past 5 days in business and the global economy. For that, we've got Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal, Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post as well. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Catherine, let me start with you, and we're going to go bang, bang, quick, rapid fire here for the first 2 minutes. GDP came out this week. Not so great first quarter. Do you care? And if so, why?
I care, but I don't care. Or at least I'm not that concerned about it, I guess. Right. Yes, it was disappointing. Came in way below expectations. But I'm still pretty bullish on where the economy is heading. I think we've had like a little bit of a blip in the data recently, but wages are going up. There are a lot of things to be excited about, or at least more optimistic about,
Fair
I should
enough.
Say.
Sudeep, same question to you. Do you care? If so, why? And also, what is it worth first quarters in this economy? Because this is like the fifth or sixth first quarter in the row where we've gone, oops.
I do care, and it says something perhaps about our measurement of the first quarter in the economy to see disappointments like this. But it does say something about Americans that after 6 years of disappointments, expecting GDP to pick up and not seeing the kind of acceleration we want, we still keep the faith that we're going to have stronger economic growth ahead. I'm like Catherine, I still think it will happen, but we do have to start to accept the fact that there are a lot of forces in the world holding back the economy, and some of those forces could weigh us down even longer.
You sound almost like a central banker, which will get us to my next point. Catherine, the Federal Reserve had a meeting this week, basically meh. What do you got? Anything?
They said as close to nothing as they could possibly say, which I think was their intention, of course.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's watching them to see when they're going to finally start inching up rates. It's been, what, 6 years now since we've had zero rates, 0% rates. You know, I think they still don't know, which is probably why they're trying to say as little as possible.
Well, I mean, Janet Yellen says that every time, right? Sudeep, she says the data will tell. And so far, the data just is not doing it for them.
The data is very confusing. And when you talk, when you hear from central bankers in public and you talk to them in private, they're pretty clear about how confused they are about the direction of the economy and how worried they are about some of these risks, because they don't know whether these are going to turn out to be big risks or small risks. And that's why we're actually seeing some of the very bizarre market volatility where investors can't make up their minds at all about whether they should sell everything and go home or buy, as they've been doing for several years.
Well, that takes care of item three on my list, volatility. Thank you very much. We'll skip that one. Let's go instead, Catherine, very quickly over to Europe. The Greeks, there's more hullabaloo, there's more false deadline, there's more, you know, people are annoyed at Yanis Varoufakis, the Greek finance minister. Does this have an end game, do you think, that does not involve constantly kicking the can down the road so that they don't have to throw the Greeks out of the European Union or the Eurozone?
It sort of has felt like we've been asking that question for 5 years since they've got their first initial bailout.
Right.
I think they're going to kick it down the road as long as they can, as long as they can keep that up. I mean, I don't know that that's a sustainable strategy in the long term, but, you know, figuring out a way to get Greece out of the Eurozone would be so very, very painful that I think no one even wants to consider planning for it at this point.
There is no way to make this have a denouement, right, Sudeep, that doesn't involve one way or the other. They're in or they're out. Let's make a decision.
It has to. It's going to be ugly in the end. It's going to be ugly by making the decision, because then it will be to leave, which will obviously hurt Greece a lot. Or even the decision for Greece to stay in is going to require all of these other Eurozone governments to step up and say, OK, we're willing to do another bailout of Greece. Because even if they get through this current period that they're facing, this false deadline of the weekend or the coming weeks, they will then have to come up with another bailout this summer. So all we're talking about is getting by for a few months and then having to figure out an even larger package to keep such a small country in the Eurozone despite 5 years of lessons about why it's not working.
Seems like forever. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He is in Washington. Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. She is in New York, just because that's the way these things work. Thanks, you guys. We'll see you later.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street Today, thy name, as Sudeep said, was volatility. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Maryland State's Attorney for Baltimore City, Marilyn Mosby, announced this morning that she has filed charges against the six police officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray. Mosby called into question almost everything the officers did, including the very arrest itself, which she said was illegal. The police union, in its own press conference this afternoon, it should be noted, said Mosby's actions were a rush to judgment. But one of the many questions that Mosby took after making her statement was this one. What needs to be done to make sure what happened to Freddie Gray doesn't happen again? The audio is bad, which is why I'm translating that question for you. She had in the crowd a one-word answer.
Accountability.
To that end, then, there has been a lot of talk, especially since Michael Brown and Ferguson, about body cams, about having recorded evidence of police interactions with the public, such as traffic stops, domestic disputes, on up to robberies and shootings. Today, Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced a $20 million Justice Department pilot project to give body cams to selected police departments across the country. So we are going to be spending some time over the next couple of weeks looking at policing, at how it's changing as a job and as part of the economy. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off with body cams in our series Behind the Blue Line.
This is what many of us think of as the sound of policing. But these days, there's a good chance it'll also sound like this.
Now try to play a video. It said it finished installing. Okay. Doesn't play well with Internet Explorer.
Yeah, cops as IT grunts on the brave new frontier of video monitoring. Officer Randall Peterson is working the day shift in Rialto, California. It's a small working-class city east of Los Angeles with a mixed population, black, Hispanic, and white.
Rialto Police. Hi, is your brother home?
Since 2013 here in Rialto, the police department has equipped all 100 of its sworn officers with body cams.
Do you have a picture of him?
Officer Peterson, former Marine, 2 years on the force, is wearing one today as he hunts for a suspect in an alleged assault.
So, long story short, husband and wife have issues, somebody visits, somebody breaks a window.
Rialto is an early adopter, deploying the body cams department-wide because of its police chief, Tony Farrar. A few years ago, he was studying criminology through a program at Cambridge University in the UK. He suggested to his professors that they use his department to study the impact of body cams on policing. He says the results have been impressive.
We've got less officer complaints, less times that we have to use force. Hopefully, an increase in public trust, an increase in credibility, and the overall legitimacy of policing.
But not everybody in the department was on board to hit the streets packing video.
Some of the more seasoned officers, if you will, had a few more questions.
What they didn't have is a choice. The policy, worked out with the police union, requires officers to videotape encounters with the public and punishes those who don't. Farrar says all the videotaping hasn't crimped his veteran officer's style, on patrol or at headquarters.
Officers sometimes have a very unique way of relieving stress and tension and pulling pranks on each other. And I went downstairs to briefing the other day and they kind of ripped me apart. So we don't arbitrarily search videos looking for officers that did something wrong or may have said something wrong.
Back out on the beat, Officer Peterson views his body cam as personal protection as he searches for his suspect.
Because there's a huge potential for him to, one, make a spontaneous statement that, yes, he did commit the offense, or say he decides he wants to run or fight.
At which point, the video could help defend Peterson against accusations of misconduct or brutality.
Personally, that's a big part of my job, is protecting myself from civil liability. And why not help myself? That's how I see it.
But there's still a lot of debate among criminal justice experts as to whether more videotaping will really help good cops defend their use of force or protect the public when bad cops go over the line. Professor Maki Haberfeld runs the program in law and police science at John Jay College. She says police critics can easily misinterpret what's recorded on video and take it out of context.
It's going to be scrutinized against some sort of standards that are truly unrealistic. People who do not understand how police work is done properly. Certain situations appear to be abusive while they're not.
Haberfeld predicts that increasingly ubiquitous video monitoring of police, plus officials and civil rights lawyers scrutinizing all that video for evidence of misconduct, will make officers on the beat afraid to use force when they need to.
They will second guess themselves, they will hesitate, and it can potentially create a danger.
Of course, cops could just turn off their video recorders when they're in a dangerous situation or one that just looks bad. But that would violate police policy and infuriate police critics. In fact, some advocates are already calling for police body cams to be on, recording all the time. Lou Maltby runs the National Work Rights Institute. He says it would be oppressive to work on camera every minute of the day.
But there are cases where it may be necessary, like police officers. It's literally a matter of life and death. And experience has shown that we can't detect police abuse any other way.
If police were recorded all of their working day, they definitely would become the most surveilled workers in America. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Mostly I was responsible for digging the pet graves. You'd have pets that would come in dead and people would want a funeral for them.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for March. The first Grammys were awarded on May 4, 1959. It was a bi-coastal event hosted in Los Angeles and New York. And under the heading, I Heart Vegetables, May is National Salad Month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Elon Musk, he of SpaceX, and for our immediate purposes right now, Tesla, the electric car company, had a big event here in L.A. last night at which he unveiled what he is calling the Powerwall, a big battery for your home, or in a bigger version for businesses, to store up energy and wean us all off energy from the power grid. Marketplace's Scott Tong from the Sustainability Desk has been following the story. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
All right, give me a little reality check here. Should I go out and buy one of these battery system things?
Someday. There's a lot of excitement over cutting cords right now, as you know, right? Cut your landline, your cable TV line. And this suggestion is maybe your electricity cord, right? Everybody grab your scissors and just start cutting.
Right.
Well, here's the scenario for electricity. Say you have solar panels on your roof, and they are getting cheaper by the day. That makes homemade electricity during the day. But of course, when the sun goes down, you don't have any. And now enter the home battery.
Right.
That's where you can store. You can bank your energy you make during the day, and you can withdraw it at night. And boom, you can defect from the grid. That's what the cool kids say, grid defection. Now, the reality check, of course, is whether this makes money sense. Kyle.
Well, do the math for me then. I've got to spend I don't know how many thousands of dollars on solar panels, and then I got to drop $3,000 for one of these whiz-bang Tesla batteries, right?
Plus installation.
Of course, yeah.
A job creation, right?
Yes.
And then you have to do a comparison. Take your homemade kind of DIY solar energy costs and see if they're less than the price of your power bill. Now, the folks at Bloomberg New Energy Finance did some of this math, and analyst Brian Warshay there says, even with this aggressively priced Tesla battery, it doesn't make sense today for the home.
The residential market will be limited, one, because most people don't have solar power. Two, most people that do have solar power are already saving money on their electricity bill without any sort of storage. And in the U.S., for the most part, the power grid is quite reliable and quite cheap. So it does make sense for people to remain grid connected.
And so, Kai, a more likely scenario is for homeowners to partially defect from the grid. You know, solar panels and a battery and keep your small utility bill. And, you know, by one projection, perhaps kind of full grid defection in 2 decades or so.
So what I hear you saying is not quite, right?
Yeah, I mean, listen, there's promise. This could be the big original cell phone, you know, the one that took two hands to hold. However, the promise of the great battery of tomorrow, we have seen this movie before.
All right, talk to me very quickly about the corporate angle here for Tesla, because they are spending a whole bunch of money on a battery factory out in Nevada, right?
That's right.
Right.
The Gigafactory. And they're going to need giga customers to buy these batteries. And so this could work into that formula. If they make a lot of batteries for the home, that could be part of their customer base.
I think the corporate synergy, right? Is that the word?
It all goes together.
Scott Tong from the Sustainability Desk in Washington. Thanks, Scott.
Okay, you're welcome.
Nothing in life, the saying has long been, is free. That's true for today's digital economy as well, even though I grant you we're still trying to figure it out, the we here being content providers. Podcasts are having their content moment in the sun right now, which, believe you me, they are trying to capitalize on. And by capitalize, I mean make money from, which means in turn, ads. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn got together with the data journalism folks over at 538.com to see exactly what kind of ads on podcasts we're talking about here. Here's Stan.
The most listened to podcasts come mostly from public radio, Serial, Invisibilia, This American Life. But the most listened to podcast advertisers...
Hey, everyone. Today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace.
Audible.com.
Stamps.com. Now, we got a really great deal for you.
Many of our advertisers are the same advertisers you hear on Howard Stern.
Lex Friedman sells podcast ads for Midroll. And right now, the gray box of an office he's in is empty. But soon, it'll be filled with desks, some for salespeople chasing more household name advertisers, like Universal Pictures or Coca-Cola. Why?
Here's the crass answer. They have deeper pockets, right? So if you can get Coca-Cola or car companies or studios... They have deep pockets. They have big budgets.
Big budgets that let them buy in bulk, spending less per ad, but buying more ads overall. And you can see why podcast industry types want this by looking at the data set put together by 538 intern Haley Mungia. She spent 2 entire days listening to the latest episode of every single podcast in the iTunes Top 100 and writing down all the ads. There were 186.
Yeah, that sounds about right. It was a lot.
But more than a third of the shows she listened to had no ads. And on the other 2/3, the median number of ads was just 2, mostly host-read scripts for mid-sized companies selling online.
For the most part, I would say they all kind of blended together. But yeah, there were a few that stood out as being particularly terrible.
For instance,
live reads. Here we go.
Comedian Bill Burr's pre-Valentine's Day endorsement of Sherry's Berries. Chocolate-dipped berries you can buy online.
Show her you thought of something unique and different this year and get her the gift she is sure to love, Sherry's Berries. Yeah, get her something unique. Get her something that you and 4 million other people are going to get.
Yeah, there it is. I was like, I wonder if anyone from Sherry's Berries ever listened to him read this ad.
So did I. So I played it for their acquisition marketing director, Nick Fairbairn.
I mean, is that fall within our brand standards? Probably not. Is it authentic to Bill Burr, the comedian, in a podcast space that's not nationally regulated for language? Yeah, it's right on brand for him. And gosh, it was ROI positive, too.
ROI as in return on investment. As in that ad sold a lot of berries. Maybe because it doesn't sound like a typical ad.
Keep it authentic. Don't force it. I think that's the key to doing this stuff.
He knows it works because of a different part of the ad.
Go to berries.com, click on the microphone, and type in my code BURR, B-U-R-R.
Something Bill Burr repeated.
But you have to use my code BURR, B-U-R-R.
Over.
You just got to use my code.
And over.
BURR.
These codes are the norm for today's podcast advertisers. But the question is, by proving that podcast ads can move berries, do they also prove their value for companies that don't count coupons, like, say, Coca-Cola?
Oh, by no means is it perfect for anybody.
Derek Liu is a strategist at the Media Kitchen, which buys ads for companies like Goldman Sachs. He says it isn't just that it's risky to hand your brand over to someone else's voice. It's that without coupon codes, you can't really track who's listening.
It's hard to measure engagement. It's hard to measure and track the user journey.
And unlike radio or TV, advertisers don't get huge audiences in exchange.
They're there because they can reach a very niche audience where they couldn't otherwise have reached them.
So my sense of where podcasts will go.
Cheryl Main is at the Interactive Advertising Bureau, and she thinks one possibility is that podcasts just stay niche.
It's a craft almost. And in the craft business, sometimes if you get a high enough unit price, you don't need to sell mass.
In other words, as long as the top podcasts can charge high rates for ads selling berries, websites, and stamps, they may be just fine without Coca-Cola. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
At 538, intern Stan was talking to, she listened to 100 podcasts to get her data. They put the spreadsheet on their website. It's 538.com. Doing book interviews a slightly different way this week. Forget the straight-ahead question and answer thing. We're taking a book by Merritt Watts. It's called First Jobs, True Tales of Bad Bosses, Quirky Coworkers, Big Breaks, and Small Paychecks. And we're doing a bunch of audio postcards about the people who had the jobs the title is talking about. So today, a first job that you ought to just listen for yourself.
My name is Jesse Kowalsik, and my first job was working at a pet cemetery, digging the graves. When I was around two, my family moved to South Florida because my dad had gotten out of drug rehab, and that's where the rehab was. He got hired by the Tri-County Humane Society. They kind of promoted him to working at the pet cemetery. When I was around 12 or 13, I started working for him there on weekends and after school some days because I wanted to work and I wanted to spend time with him, and it seemed like just the thing to do. Mostly I was responsible for digging the pet graves. You'd have pets that would come in dead and people would want a funeral for them, and so you would choose a casket based on the size of the pet and then you'd have to dig a grave. There were these little plywood rectangles of different sizes that you would start the grave with just to get an idea of what size it should be, and you'd dig around the edges of that until you have kind of a template, and then you dig down 3-4 feet deep, and that's where the casket would go after the funeral service. I really appreciated what my dad did for our family. He had this really hard job, and for every pet grave I dug, he must have dug half a dozen. And he never complained, and he never asked for anything else. People would come in grieving their pets, and I always thought it was a little bit strange to, you know, have a funeral for your pet. What always struck me was how helpful he was to them and how supportive he was. He really just, you know, met them where they were, and he would hold a little funeral service. He'd say some words, some brief words about the pet, and even play a little bit of flute music for them. And it was really interesting to see him in that role. Seeing my dad take a job that could have really just been, you know, a menial labor type job and really use it to help people gave me a sense of what was important and what I should be doing with my life.
Jesse Kowalsik now works as a family therapist and a school counselor up in Oakland, California. This final note on the way out today, which I will preface by saying I am not going to be one of those shelling out $89.95 to watch the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight tomorrow night. But millions of other people will, which gets us to this tidbit that CNBC has put together. Assuming Floyd Mayweather makes, as has been predicted, $120 million or more, that means he will make in just one night more than the following companies had in profits all of last year. Sotheby's, the auction house, Cheesecake Factory, GoPro, also Smith & Wesson, and Kate Spade. $120 million one night. Help me understand that. All right, the Dow up 1% today, about 183 points. The NASDAQ regained 1.25%, 63 points. S&P 500 closed 1% higher, 22 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. Tommy Andres is the acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We'll see you back here, Monday. Let's do it Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.